As we move into chapter 13, we are continuing in that section of the epistle that has a great deal to say about the 3.5 year period that runs up to the last trump and to the visible appearing of the Lord Jesus. Chapter 11 first introduced us to that 3.5 year period that climaxes in the sounding of the seventh angel as the last trump is blown and Christ appears in power and glory. In chapter 11, we were instructed that that 3.5 year period was marked by the ministry of two men known as the two witnesses preaching in the city of Jerusalem. In chapter 12, we learned that that 3.5 year period is a time in which God is even still at work to stymie the efforts of the devil to further curtail the opposition of Satan against the Church of Christ and even to preserve a church in Jerusalem and in the Judean wilderness under the nose of the devil and the Antichrist himself. But now as we move into chapter 13, we come to focus upon a slightly different aspect of that 3.5 year period that precedes the visible appearing of the Lord Jesus Christ. In this chapter, we are concentrating upon the activities of the Antichrist in that particular period of time. Just as in the ordinary affairs of life, we can have various perspectives on the events that are happening in any one moment of time. If we were to take a half a dozen different views of life in this city at this moment, each of them would be different. But yet each of them are concurrent. Each of them are true. There are things happening at one end of the city and different things happening elsewhere in the city. And so it is with prophecy. We have various perspectives, various snapshots of the same time, the same environment, the same circumstances sometimes, but different perspectives. And even while the witnesses are preaching, and even while that church that's represented in chapter 12 is being preserved by God in the wilderness and the devil is beginning his great rampage in the earth, there's something else happening concurrently that we're introduced to in this chapter. Here we have the first extended reference to the Antichrist and his work at this period of time in this particular epistle. Now, this is not the first time, obviously, in the Bible that the Antichrist appears. We will have something to say about what Daniel writes about this same individual that helps us understand what John is speaking of here. Here is an individual who dominates prophecy. An individual who, even alongside the Lord Jesus Christ himself, dominates much of what the Bible has to say all the way through. Here is the great devilish alternative to the Christ of God. But it's not surprising that, especially in those passages that deal with the future and the climax of human history, that we find a particular strong emphasis upon the character and the work of the one who is called the man of sin. Now, God's people are to know about this. There are subjects in the Bible that Christians may be disposed to show some interest in, but not really prepared to study. The verse 9 tells us, "If any man have an ear, let him hear." Here is a message that needs to be listened to. Here is a word outlining some of the details about the Antichrist, and God's people are not to ignore it. Every man that has an ear, and even we may use the word in a physical sense, is to hear. But especially, there is a spiritual application. And if God has opened the ear of your understanding and your soul in the new birth and given you an ear for His Word, you must listen to this. This is not something to be ignored, not something that can be put off. There are Christians who believe that it's not worth the effort studying what the Bible has to say on this subject, that it'll all work out however it works out, and it's not worth my while figuring it out now. Well, that, to put it bluntly, is an act of disobedience, because it's disobedience to this explicit statement: if any man have an ear, let him hear. We are to listen. We are to hear with understanding and with intelligence what God has said on this subject. And I believe that the closer we get to the end, the more wrong and the more wicked it is on the part of God's people to refuse to give attention to these matters. We are in the last days. We see the signs even of these things starting to shape up in our own time. We see the marks of the apostasy. It's not hard to see those things that the Bible does speak of beginning to form on the horizon, as it were, even from our perspective. We need to have an ear, and we need to use it as we consider these matters. Now we're going to consider the rise of the Antichrist at this point. And we'll look at some of the contents, at least, of the first 10 verses of this chapter. We're going to think about the rise of the Antichrist. The final part of the chapter is going, obviously, to focus upon another beast, referred to as the false prophet, who comes to be the right-hand man of the Antichrist. But we're going to think about him in due course. But for now, we're going to think about the rise of the beast that is spoken of in the opening verses of the chapter. In some ways, these first 10 verses are a summary. We've seen that kind of approach before in this epistle, where there is an overview given. And when we get to verse 10, we actually have a description of the demise of the Antichrist. And there's an overview here of this particular aspect of his career in the 3.5 years for the encouragement of the people of God. As we look at the rise of the beast as he is described here, obviously beginning in the verse 1, there's something that we need to understand right away, and that is that this is not his initial appearance. This is not his initial rise to prominence. I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. Now the timing of this rise is significant. He is rising to his final phase of prominence. The 3.5 years that are in view here, the Antichrist rising to particular prominence in this 3.5 year period, he is rising to the pinnacle of his political and spiritual influence. Yet at this point on the prophetic timeline, he has already been in prominence for some time. In Revelation 17, which we'll get to in due course, but in Revelation 17, in the verse 3, I'm going to read some verses here, beginning in verse 3. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. Now, obviously, it's the same beast. But we're actually considering him now at an earlier point in his career. You'll notice the absence of crowns at this point. He has 7 heads and 10 horns, and the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration. The angel said unto me, Wherefore didst thou marvel? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carrieth her, which hath the 7 heads and 10 horns. The beast that thou sawest was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell upon the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. We actually have a view of the Antichrist at an earlier phase of his career, when he is under subjection to this Babylonish harlot, this religious system that he is in subjection to. He's real, he's there, he's in the background, as it were, but he is in subjection, not yet wearing the crowns that appear in Revelation chapter 13. And in fact, chronologically speaking, Revelation 13 takes up where Revelation 17, the vision of Revelation 17, actually ends. He has been prominent for some time. He's already in existence here in this vision in Revelation 17. And by the time we look at him in chapter 13, although it's an earlier chapter, it's actually a later point on the prophetic timeline that charts his career. If we turn back to those familiar words that we have looked at many times in Daniel chapter 9 and the verse 26, verse 26, after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself, and the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war desolations are determined. And he, that's the prince, this is a reference to the Antichrist, he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, or for a period of 7 years. And then in the midst of that week, he shall cause the sacrifice of and the oblation to cease, and for the overspreading of abominations, he shall make it desolate. That's the abomination of desolation referred to, that is set up, we've mentioned this before, set up at this 3.5 year period. He's already been in prominence for at least 3.5 years prior to this period, in terms of his connection with the nation of Israel. And very likely, he has been in prominence even on the political scene for years before that. Because he comes into prominence with Israel at that 7 years to go mark as a world leader, as a military figure, and as one of great importance and prominence in that entire region. So when we come to Revelation 13, we're not looking at the first appearance of the Antichrist, but rather we're looking at what we could describe as the final step in his career, rising to the pinnacle of his apostasy and his defiance of God. Here will be the high point of his career of blasphemous apostasy against God. Now, you'll notice his origin here. He rises, we are told, out of the sea in chapter 13, verse 1. The reference is to the Mediterranean. He's rising out of the Mediterranean area. The area around this sea is the geographic location for his political power base. His 10-kingdom confederacy is based in the Mediterranean area. The visions of Daniel especially make it very clear that the Antichrist, as far as his political empire is concerned, emerges from the old Roman Empire, and its territory was basically wrapped around the Mediterranean Sea. In Daniel chapter 2, We read there in that opening prophetic vision of Daniel's book, Daniel chapter 2 and the verse 40, and the fourth kingdom, which is a reference to the Romans, the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, the two legs, the pelvis and two legs of the vision, shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Now notice there the reference in verse 42, the fourth kingdom. And verse 41, the kingdom. It's the same kingdom. It's the same empire essentially. Even though in the vision that Daniel is describing here, in that great iron image of a man composed of various metals representing the development of human empire from Babylon down through the Medo-Persians to the Greeks and then to the Romans. But it's the same empire. There's only the fourth kingdom. There's only four kingdoms. The fourth kingdom, the Roman Empire, dividing into the two legs, the east and western parts of the Roman Empire. That has already happened. It happened long ago. But the ten-toe phase of that Roman Empire has not yet happened. It is still to develop. And we are told in verse 44, in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and that kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Then when we get to Daniel chapter 8 and the verse 23 and 24, again we have a reference to the Antichrist in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full. That's not actually the reference that I'm looking for. It's chapter 7 and verse 23. Then he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down and break it in pieces. And the ten horns out of this kingdom are ten kings that shall arise, and another shall rise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first. And verse 25, he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High. This is the Antichrist. Where does he emerge from? The ten horns of the Roman Empire. The same idea that's conveyed in the imagery of Daniel chapter 2. This is where he emerges from. The ten kingdom confederacy stage of the Roman Empire. And where's that based? It was based in the Mediterranean area. That is where Antichrist will arise from. This will be the center of his operations. Now, at this point in his career, 3.5 years to go, 42 months that are spoken of there in verse 5, at this point in his career, he makes Jerusalem his base. Babylon is very definitely and explicitly his city. But at this point, he makes Jerusalem a base, especially as far as the worship that Antichrist ushers in at this point. Jerusalem becomes his base. He annexes the temple and its worship to himself. And we'll look at that when we consider the setting up of the abomination of desolation. But this is where this final phase of his rise to prominence is going to be seen. Right there in the Mediterranean area, especially we're looking at the city of Jerusalem. Now, as we think about the vision here, we have the nature of the beast impressed upon us. The nature of the beast. What can we learn about his character from the language of these verses? Well, the description that is given to us there in the verse 1, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. This multi-headed beast, seven heads, ten horns, with crowns upon each of the ten horns. The language of the vision simply describes a man representing a kingdom that is composed of ten subordinate kingdoms, represented by the ten horns, in which, that kingdom that is represented here, this empire, this man and his organization, is to be seen the embodiment of human wisdom, ingenuity, and authority and power. Seven heads, the head being a symbol of authority, rule, wisdom, thought, ingenuity, all of these ideas linked with the imagery of a head. And here is a beast with seven heads. Seven often being linked with the idea of completeness and perfection. Here is a man and an empire, an organization that he represents, in which there is to be seen the very best that man can think of, conceive of, produce. It is the embodiment of human power. It's interesting that when Daniel gives us that vision in chapter 2 that sets out a very clear timeline to human history running up to the return of the Lord Jesus Christ, it's the image of a man. And when those ten toes are in place, that ten kingdom confederacy that is represented here by the ten horns, when that is in place, all that man is, all that man aspires to, will be seen in all of its glory, in all of its wonder, and all of its power, and all of its might, and of course in all of its depravity as well. But here is the epitome of all that man aspires to be and determines to be. Now in chapter 17, we've already referred to that chapter. Look at the verse 12. The ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings. And at the point of the vision in chapter 17, they have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. By the time we get to the point in the timeline that chapter 13 is dealing with, the ten horns have crowns. These kings are now in place. This ten kingdom confederacy is very much in view and in focus. Daniel chapter 7, the verse 24, we also have a reference to the horns. The ten horns out of this kingdom, out of the Roman kingdom, are ten kings that shall arise. So there's no real difficulty in understanding the language that's used here. Seven heads, ten horns, representing a ten kingdom empire in which is to be seen all of the ingenuity and power and wisdom and authority of man. Everything that might be symbolized by a head seen in its completeness and perfection as far as man's perspective is concerned. Now there's both a man then and an organization that is in view in this symbol. And John sees this man and the organization that he fronts emerging to prominence for this final 3.5 year, 42-month period of time immediately prior to the appearance of Christ. Now as we look closer at the description, we find what we could describe as the political DNA of the Antichrist. We can trace his political pedigree that's given to us in verse 2. The beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. Now the Antichrist is a political figure who dominates world politics at the end. We're told in chapter and verse 7, the final phrase of the verse, that power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. In a sense, he will influence the world. But those 10 kingdoms in the Mediterranean area will especially be the sphere of his influence and power. That will be the epicenter of Antichrist's activity, political and religious. The language of the vision traces his political ancestry in that area. Again, we must go back to the book of Daniel. And Daniel chapter 7, we're going to read at the verse 3. Daniel chapter 7, the verse 3, and four great beasts came up from the sea. It's the same sea, the same Mediterranean. Because sometimes that area is known as the prophetic earth. The Bible has really focused upon that area. Much of what it has to say is exclusively related to that Mediterranean territory. Four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. The first was like a lion and an eagle's wings. Verse 5, another beast, a second, like to a bear. And then verse 6, after this I beheld, and lo, another, like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, strong, exceedingly, great iron teeth, and so on. Now, you'll know already that this is a reference to the four great empires that are prominent on God's prophetic timeline. The lion, referring to Babylon. The bear, the second empire, Medo-Persia. The leopard, the Greeks. And then the fourth beast representing the Romans. Now when we come to the description of the Antichrist in Revelation chapter 13, you will see that the beast is first described as like unto a leopard. There is no accidental use of the language here. We are to make a connection with what Daniel has said. This beast is predominantly Grecian. It's linked with Daniel's vision of the third empire. There are other aspects to its character, but the main likeness is to a leopard. The main likeness is going to be to the Grecian Empire. And the ethos and the philosophy that drove Grecian society is going to be seen again when the Antichrist comes to prominence. There is a reference to the bear in verse 2 and to the lion in verse 2. There will be characteristics that will be seen in this man of sin that can be traced back to Greece, back to Babylon, back to the Medo-Persian power of former times. Here, if you like, is his political pedigree. But preeminently, he is Grecian as far as his political DNA is concerned. Now that too is the emphasis of Daniel's prophecy. In Daniel chapter 7, we have a timeline set out for us, these four beasts, and then out of the fourth beast, out of the 10 horns of the fourth beast, the Roman Empire, emerges the little horn, the man of sin. That gives us the chronology of his emergence. But in chapter 8 of Daniel, we have similar vision, only the little horn emerges on the beast that represents Greece. And it's not the chronology of his emergence, but it's in actual fact the ethnic origin, the pedigree of the Antichrist that is in view. Chronologically, he emerges out of Rome. But as far as perhaps his ethnicity or the character of his rule and his kingdom and his philosophy, as the man of sin is concerned, he's emerging from Greece. That's why he's described here as being predominantly like unto a leopard. The hallmarks of Greek society are going to be seen again. The old Grecian territories. We look at Daniel 11 and we see the reference there to the king of the north. One of the divisions of the Grecian Empire following on from Alexander's death. Daniel 8 makes the same thing clear, that this is where he emerges from. This is where he's going to come from. That territory that was so long ago identified with one section of Alexander's kingdom. Now, we're looking here at a political context. And whenever you have a confederacy of 10 kingdoms and the history that goes way back even to Nebuchadnezzar, you have a history of conflict. And it's going to be no different. As the man of sin emerges, as he rises to this position of prominence, there is conflict, even internal strife, that is in view. We find in verse 3 that even at this critical phase of his advance, I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed. There is conflict that is suggested here. There is a reference there to the sword. A little later in the chapter, the beast that which had the wound by a sword and did live. The sword, of course, being a weapon of war. And at some point, leading up to this 3.5 year mark, it appears there is a military setback for his kingdom that is almost lethal, almost fatal, almost is the end for him. That, of course, will be a challenge to the faith of God's people. As far as the prophetic scriptures are concerned, I have no doubt that many saints will, even at that point, have already identified the man of sin, and then suddenly here is this individual and the organization that he represents, and it's teetering on the brink of collapse. But even that, those that are astute in the things of God will recognize this is but a further evidence that this is in fact the beast, and where do you see what's going to happen next? But he has this deadly wound. His empire, his organization receives a serious setback. Now there is an insight, I believe, given to us in the 11th chapter of Daniel to the conflict and the skirmishes and the battles that precede this point in Antichrist's career. I take the view that Daniel 11 and verse 5 marks the section of this chapter that is for the future. And there is conflict between the king of the south and the king of the north and various successors in those kingdoms. And one of those kings, he's the third king of the north that's referred to in Daniel 11. He's the Antichrist. He's the man of sin. He's the vile person. The fourth king of the north actually is the Antichrist. He stands up as the vile person and comes to prominence in that particular northern section of the Grecian Empire. But we read an interesting little detail in Daniel 11 and the verse 30 that occurs just at this very point in time. That the ships of Chittim, and that's Greece, shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do. He shall even have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. And goes on in verse 31, take away the daily sacrifice and place the abomination of desolation. That's right at the 3.5 year mark. And here there is a battle initially between himself and the king of the south, that's down in the territory of Egypt. And there is some act of treachery that takes place, and the ships, the army, the navy of Chittim from Greece, which is one of his own kingdoms, comes against him. And he's grieved. And clearly there's a setback. There's a defeat here of some kind that immediately turns his attention toward Jerusalem and to the temple and the setting up of the abomination of desolation. And I don't think that we are stretching things too much to make the connection. I think that as time develops these things and we come to that point in time, we'll see what the connection is more clearly. But I'm saying to you, there is a connection between what is described in Daniel 11:30 and what is described here in Revelation 13 and the verse 3. I see a connection here. It's at that same point in time, at any rate, as the 3.5 years begin. Here's his political background that is brought to our attention then in these verses. The link with the past. The emergence out of various world empires that we have already seen, that have already been described, have come and gone on the scene of human history. Part of the significance of that is always to emphasize that the Antichrist is going to be a real man. He's going to be as real as Alexander the Great. He's going to be as real as Caesar, as real as Nebuchadnezzar. His city is going to be a real Babylon. The things that he's going to do are going to be real actions. He's got a real army. He's going to fight real battles. This is real. This is not just some sort of figment of prophetic imagination. This is as real as anything that has happened in the history of mankind to date. There's one other aspect of his political pedigree that we need just to pay attention to. Verse 2. The dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. The devil gave him his power, his seat and great authority. The throne that Antichrist will occupy is a throne in which the power of the devil is at work. His power over men, his authority over men, his throne, his political establishment involves the work of the devil. Now we've already seen in chapter 12 that the devil is as busy on the earth during this period of time as he has ever been. The devil is at work here. He has just been defeated in heaven. He has just been consigned to the earth. He's just beginning that rampage against the people of God and against the nation of Israel. And the devil is at work. Here is a kingdom that is solidly based upon devilish ability, devilish power, satanic ingenuity and malice and depravity. Chapter 11, the verse 7. There's a little incidental reference to the rise of the Antichrist in a more generic sense. The beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit. Oh, that's where his pedigree needs to be traced back to. His kingdom, his person, his character, his work originates in hell. Now, this puts modern politics in a very different light. Because what you are reading here is the emergence upon the world stage at a particular point in human history of a leading politician, a leading political figure. And he's animated, motivated, empowered by the devil. More and more as we come toward the end, the politics of mankind are going to be marked by the devil's power, the devil's purposes, the devil's intentions. Some Christians have the idea that the church should have nothing to do with politics. I know in a sense that may be true. But the church cannot afford to ignore and bury its head in the sand the developments that are taking place in the political world. It very much is the church's mandate to have an interest in politics, to be a commentator on politics. It is very much, I believe, from a biblical perspective, the mandate of a gospel preacher to exercise a commentary in the light of Scripture on political developments. The agenda of the devil is at work in the world's political affairs. And when we get to this point that Revelation 13 is describing, we're looking at the direct involvement of the devil in an unprecedented fashion to elevate a king, to promote a kingdom, to promote an administration whose sole aim and object is the destruction of Christ and his kingdom. Sadly, there are many Christians that are prepared to ignore what's happening in the world. There are many Christians, perhaps in an even more tragic fashion, are prepared to facilitate what is happening in the world by being part of and helping to advance the devil's agenda in the political sphere. But here is this great political figure emerging in the Mediterranean area, and his pedigree is traced back to hell. In conclusion, I want us to have a look at the spiritual role that Antichrist is described as having here in these verses, because he will be a formidable figure in the religious activity of the earth. His heads, we are told, are stamped with the identity of blasphemy. All of his wisdom, all of his ingenuity, all of his governmental ability, stamped all over, hallmarked with the name of blasphemy. His mouth is filled with blasphemy against God, verse 6. Daniel, when he speaks of him as that little horn that speaks great things and blasphemies against God. Verse 6. He opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. The Antichrist is in fact the epitome of human apostasy. He is the fruit of the convergence of all of the religion of man. Ultimately, all of man's religious, moral ideas will converge into one rotten, blasphemous, apostate character. Now, go back to chapter 17 and the verse 5. Let me show you the final two steps in this convergence. Here is this Babylonish harlot in this vision. There are two figures in this vision. The harlot and the beast. The harlot is representative in verse 5 of mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. In other words, she's presented as the source of all error, of all false worship. But all of that false worship has converged again at this point in human history into one figure, the woman, the harlot. This Babylonish system of religion, it's a system of religion that syncretizes all falsehood. Everything comes together. This is the great outcome of what we describe as the ecumenical movement. The bringing together of all falsehoods. The harlot here is not Rome. Rome is just one part of it. The harlot here is every form of falsehood ever known to man. And for a time, that's what will be seen during the Antichrist's career. But there's one more step. In the verse 16, the 10 horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hit the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. For God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will, and to agree, and give their kingdom unto the beast. And that amalgamation of human error and false religion, every form of it that has ever been known in human history, coming together in the conglomerate religion of these 10 kingdoms, is then itself replaced by the beast. The beast. He becomes the object of worship. And in this way, we are taught that all of human error, all of man's apostasy, converging and being epitomized in at the last. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 deals with this as well. And we'll just pick out a couple of verses here. Paul speaks of the apostasy that precedes the coming of Christ. And out of that apostasy, emerging the man of sin. As the one great fruit of that apostasy. That wicked one. And he sits as God in the temple of God. Showing himself that he is God. Now this is the rise that John is describing. The final step in the revelation of the Antichrist as the man of sin. The epitome, the personification of apostasy and wicked departure from God. He sets up the abomination of desolation. We'll look at that next time in the will of God. But in his blasphemy again, God. Presenting himself as God, he sets himself up as the object of worship. And in actual fact, what is he doing? He is directing the worship of his devotees to the devil. Men become devil worshippers. In a sense, that has been true all the way down through history. As they worshipped their idols, they worshipped devils. But we are told here very specifically, all that dwell upon the earth, verse 8, shall worship him. They worship the beast, verse 4. And in verse 12, the false prophet causeth the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast. They worshipped the dragon, verse 4. In worshipping Antichrist as God, they worship the devil. This is where the course of human history is headed to. This is the rise that John sees and records here. What a step. The last great step of apostasy. Just 3.5 years from the end. When King Jesus will come and destroy the man of sin with the breath of his mouth and the brightness of his coming. This is the beast. The Lord says, if you've got an ear, you're to hear this. You're to know this. He's coming. There are many antichrists, John tells us. But the Antichrist will come. It's important for us in this day to recognize the character of the Antichrist. We may not live to see the personal man of sin, but we for sure will come across many who share his identity and his DNA and his character, and we're to stand against them. We're to recognize them. We're to see them for what they are. That's why it's important for us to hear this and to know it. May God give us understanding in these things. Open our eyes to the apostasy of today. It's not just an abstract that has no personal significance. Apostasy is real, and it's beating at the door of the church. It comes in. The church's fight with apostasy is a bit like those images we have seen in recent days with the spring flooding in several places, where there's an ongoing battle with the floodwaters, and it seeps in, and you have to mop it up and throw it out, get rid of it. Keep mopping it up and mopping it up and mopping it up. That's what the church's battle with apostasy is. It comes in. It comes into our church. Because you see, the seeds of it are in my heart and in yours. It can't not come in. We must fight it wherever it shows itself, whoever it shows itself in, whoever this departure or a tendency to departure shows itself, and we have to stand against it. There can't be favoritism. We have to stand against it. Because this is anti-Christianity that's at work. Can a Christian do the devil's work? Of course. Of course you can. But we have to stand against the devil's work even in the life of a Christian. We have to fight it. May God give us the grace to do that even in these days.